Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Pan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Kathleen Wheaton. Kathleen is a journalist and travel writer. She and I will be discussing her latest award-winning book, Aliens and Other Stories. It is a loosely linked collection of stories about people in exile from their native countries and families. Good morning, Kathleen. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Johnny. I'm doing great. I'm watching the snow fall once again in Washington, D.C. as we talk.
I would love to be there. I enjoy that, but certainly, of course, not living in it.
Right.
It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me this morning. Aliens and Other Stories is a wonderful read. The writing flows very well. The human elements and drama were well expressed with fluidity, and it is a wonderful book that engages both the heart and the mind. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Let us get started by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. Well, I'm a sort of an anomaly. I'm a sixth-generation Californian. My family settled in California before the Gold Rush, and I grew up there, first in L.A. and then in Northern California. I went to college in California and left in 1979 and basically have been sort of on the move ever since. I lived in Spain for a couple of years after college, then did graduate school in Boston, lived in New York, and then I got an amazing job with a company that published travel books. And they sent me back to Spain, where I spent a year doing a book about Spain, and then to Argentina, where I met my husband when I hired him to take some photos for a book on Buenos Aires.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a reporter for National Public Radio, and he's an American, but he had been living in Argentina for several years. And then we lived in Latin America for about, we got married and we lived in Latin America for about 10 years, first in Brazil, and where our older son was born, and then in Mexico, where our younger son was born, and moved back to the States and settled in Washington, D.C., where David still works for NPR, and I've been doing magazine writing and got going on Aliens about the time that we moved back to the U.S.
I see. So, needless to say, you guys are very fluent in Argentine tango then, right?
Well, I love the music. I tend to stay off the dance floor myself, but at least when tango's playing, because it really, it is quite an art form. We both speak Spanish fluently, Portuguese, and our kids grew up speaking those languages. So we do feel comfortable in that world, I would say.
Wonderful. So I presume you have frequented the various parlors and joined in the various milongas and so forth.
Well, we did. Although I think back then, I mean, tango, of course, was very popular in the early part of the 20th century, and as those tango dancers got older, it was more kind of a dance for old people, and you'd go to these tango clubs and it would be mostly the elderly, but in recent years it's really been revived, and young people have kind of rediscovered it. And in fact, when I was looking for possible photos for the cover of my book, I just found these fantastic pictures of young tango dancers. So,
right. I just have to ask you that because I am a ballroom dancer and I do Argentine tango as well.
Oh, really? Oh, well, I'm
yes.
filled with admiration then because it's not easy. But it's beautiful. It's a beautiful dance. So.
It is. It's wonderful. And certainly one of these is I would love to go to Argentina. And what my understanding is over there, it is a contact sport.
Yes, yes. It's definitely a contact sport. And definitely, I think when you go to these places, you feel like you need to know a little bit about what you're doing, but it sounds like you do already. So that's
yes,
that's
yes,
terrific.
I do. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. So you like the music too, the Piazzolla and some of those musicians?
Yes, I do. And to me, music moves me. And so when I hear the right music that plays the right song, then it just kind of energizes me from inside out. So I like the balls, I like the milongas, and then, of course, just the regular tango in itself. But then it has to be the right music to just kind of get you going.
right. Well, it's definitely a very melancholy, nostalgic sound, and I think that's one reason that people kept dancing it their whole lives, you know, even as they got older. And hearing the music now, it definitely, especially now that it's been some 25 years since I've lived there, it definitely inspires those emotions.
Yeah, very true. When did you discover you liked to write?
Well, I would say I maybe discovered that I liked to write even before I could write. I would make up stories and kind of enact them with my younger brother and sister. And as soon as I actually learned to make letters in elementary school, I did start writing stories and reading them aloud for my family and friends. So it's something that I've always wanted to do, and I never really thought of doing anything else, actually. So,
Interesting. Were your parents an advocate of writing?
No. Well, I mean, my dad's an engineer, and my mother, she read a fair amount when we were growing up, and she read to us, and they were very encouraging. But I don't think either anyone in my family ever really thought of writing as a career, but it just nothing else really stuck with me. So
interesting. When you were growing up, who were some of the writers that inspire you?
Oh well, one of the books that I loved growing up was a book called Rascal by Sterling North, which is actually a nonfiction book about a boy growing up with a raccoon, just written in a really kind of lovely, elegiac style. I love the Little House on the Prairie books. I like historical fiction a lot. Johnny Tremaine was another huge favorite when I was a child, and Little Women I read many times. I think a lot of women writers probably, Jo March and Little Women was probably their first model of what a girl who really liked to read could do with her life.
Interesting. So do you catch yourself daydreaming a whole lot?
Daydreaming is a two-edged sword because it's clearly something that that writers need to do to kind of work up their material, but it's also something that can kind of take away your focus too. So I have been thinking a lot about daydreaming and how recently and how it can be the source of inspiration, but being able to get back to the present is also really important for actually getting something down on the page.
Very true. So what life epiphanies moved you to become a professional writer?
Well, as I said, I mean, writing always seemed to me like the thing that I wanted to do. And but at the same time, I realized that it probably wouldn't be something that I could make a living at. Mm-hmm. When I first moved to New York after graduate school, I sold a couple of short stories to the Boston Globe, Sunday Magazine, then published fiction, and they paid pretty well. And then I won a fiction contest with Red Book Magazine. And so in the space of a month, I got a fair amount of money, and I thought, well, this will be easy. I can easily make a living as a writer. And that was kind of the end of my... So I did a lot of temp work, and then when I just sort of fell into journalism, that was when I thought, well, okay, this is one way that you can make money as a writer. I mean, not make money in the get rich sense, but make a living, perhaps.
Interesting. What sort of stories interest you? Will you focus on specific theme?
Oh, well, I like stories that are layered and complicated, and I've always liked short stories that kind of cover a whole person's life. So I was always interested in especially talking to older people who had really had a lot of different experiences and who reached a sort of conclusion about their lives. And as a journalist too, I've been writing features and profiles for a local magazine for a number of years, and I like doing stories that have people as the protagonist and their kind of journey through life. So
interesting. In your writing, do you find yourself expressing your opinions or basically to entertain others?
Well, I was thinking about this because another book that I really liked a lot as a kid was a novel called Earth Abides, and it was about this man who survived some kind of a plague, and he's left in Northern California alone, and suddenly he realizes that advertisements for things like toothpaste and mouthwash and deodorant make no sense because he's by himself. Mm-hmm. And I think that that writing too, I mean, there is this idea of expressing yourself, but I think you always are expressing yourself to others. So it's hard to imagine doing that in a vacuum. And the other thing that is really important to me personally is humor. I love stories that are funny or that have some kind of a comic edge to them. And so when I'm writing, I do feel that I'm getting somewhere if I feel that I've found the humor in a situation. And I often think about whether people I know who might be reading this would find it amusing. So I think entertaining other people is, I mean, that's how storytelling first started, as a way to amuse people while you were sending off the saber-toothed tigers around the campfire.
Interesting. How is writing as a journalist different from writing a book?
Well, it's not as different as I might have thought. The main difference, obviously, is that one, a fiction book comes from your imagination, and journalism hopefully comes only from your notebook. I'm always a little bit mystified when I hear about journalists getting in trouble for making stuff up because it's a lot harder to make things up. People say the most extraordinary things in real life, and so sticking to the facts is a little bit easier than trying to make something seem real, which is what fiction writers do. But in terms of just kind of telling a story, getting from A to B, I think we all have that have that natural ability. And I've found that when I interview people and I go back later and I look at the transcript of the interview, usually it follows a narrative, and it's almost like the story is written itself, because people have this innate ability to tell stories about themselves. Even, you know, they weave back and forth, and they don't always have complete sentences, but that narrative drive, I think, is really important, and it's present in all of us.
Interesting. Do you find that you capture the essence of mood personality when you interview them, that say perhaps that are not in the words that they speak, or when you write, are you able to express that from that perspective?
Well, you know, I think that that people's voices, the way that they say things, really does express a lot of. I mean, there are these sort of nonverbal cues too.
Sure,
but. But I learned this. My husband's a radio reporter, and I learned this technique from him of transcribing tape and then going back and kind of building the story around it, because people's voices are just very expressive, and with fiction too. I think if you can get the sound of the words and figure out how they talk and how they would say certain things, I find at least that everything else falls into place.
Do you consider that as a similarity between the two areas of writing?
Yes, I would say so. I think that once you understand the voice of your, in fiction it would be your main character, or the voice of the subject of a journalism piece, I think you're about 90% of the way there, and because it is in both cases, I think it's an act of empathy and imagining what it's like to be that other person. And I've found that in journalism, that even if I'm doing a story about someone who initially I think maybe I wouldn't like so much, but once I get into the story, they seem incredibly sympathetic to me, and I always do end up really liking my subjects, and the same I think is true with fiction. You have, not liking in the sense that you admire everything about them, but you feel this real kinship with them.
Very interesting. Have you had some really memorable interviews that sort of gave you an opportunity to, like, it's a wow thing for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. I a couple of years ago, I interviewed a woman. It was a tragic story. She was from Iran, and her daughter, who was an art restorer, was the victim of a murder. And I wrote about this terrible thing that had happened to her daughter, and I interviewed a lot of her friends and her family members, and I ended up spending a lot of time with her. And I just found the whole world that she lived in and all of her friends such interesting people, and they would gather in her apartment, and the women would write poetry too, because I'd always heard that the Persian language is very poetic, and they would get together and they would say, oh, I just wrote you a poem, and I became really curious about this language where people wrote poetry to each other. So I started studying Persian actually a couple of years ago, and so I would say that had a huge impact. I'm still friends with the woman, Mary, and more I can speak to her in her own language. But it had a huge effect, because learning a language is also, I think, a way of really understanding the way people think and the way they are.
Right, and I'm glad you shared that story, because what I got from it is more from a standpoint of, in the end, we're all ordinary people. We want to live a wonderful, happy life. To each of us, we have a certain way that we do things, and there's no difference about getting together in Iran or in the Midwest.
Right, right. It was just so, I mean, so many things about these women were so kind of reminiscent of my grandmother and her friends getting together in California and talking about things. Although they didn't write poems to each other. They gave each other birthday cards, you know.
Right.
But just things, you know, centered around, and the foods were different, and and these kinds of ritual ways that you're polite. I learned, for example, very quickly, or maybe not quickly enough, that when someone offers you something, at first you're always supposed to refuse. It's rude to say, "Oh yes, I would love a cookie." Just to say no. Although my husband's from the Midwest, and there too, you're supposed to turn things down before you accept them.
Yeah.
So.
That's interesting. I encountered that when I first moved to the United States, because we were brought up in the way that, well, when they first offer you something to eat, you should say no.
Oh, really?
And yes. The whole idea, it's about politeness. There's a history that goes with it now, because what happens is that in the old days, you don't call someone before you go to their house to visit. You just show up, because there's no communication, right?
Oh, uh-huh.
So you may show up during the time that they might be having a family meal. So what you do is that you come in and they will let you sit in the living room. That's where you have magazines and whatnot to entertain you while the family finish their meal.
Oh,
however, yeah, things like this we take for granted, basically.
Uh-huh.
So what happens is that if they were to ask you, say, no, come on and join us for lunch, politely, of course, you should say no. And then they, in turn, will say, well, no, we have extra. Come on and join us for lunch. This is the interesting part right here, because they are being polite and refined, and you should say no as well, because then you are being polite and refined. Does that make sense?
Right.
Then they asked you the third time. Now, when they ask you the third time, then they do have the food to offer you. And, of course, you definitely want to say yes, because if you don't, then the table changes. It's an insult.
I see. Well, now, that's very interesting that it's the third time, because that's also what my in-laws in Minnesota said. That's the third time that they offer, that's when you should say yes. And that was true in Iran. So what country is this where
in Malaysia.
How interesting.
Yeah, in Asia as a whole, I would think, because I'm Chinese Malaysian. I was born in Malaysia. I'm a U.S. citizen, but I'm just giving you those little interesting cultural mindfulness.
That is very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so coming back to the story, when I first got to the United States, I met my Italian foster mom that asked me, do you want to eat? We're about to eat now. And I said, no. That's it. Game's over.
Right.
I end up starving myself.
Right. Yeah.
So the little cultural thing.
Right. No, I think Americans in general, if you know, you're supposed to come right out with it if you're hungry or not. So,
right.
But I think a lot of these cultural things went back to a time when, you know, food was really scarce. And,
precisely.
And so you didn't want to. One thing that I when I lived in Spain, I noticed is that people, if you saw somebody eating, I mean, even if you like walked by somebody in a park and they're eating a sandwich, you always say the equivalent of bon appetit.
Right.
Sort of, and the thing is, I think it's to let them know that you're not going to take their food away. I think that was sort of the original intention of that cultural thing, that you acknowledge the fact that someone else is eating, but I'm not a threat. You go ahead and enjoy your sandwich. I'm not going to take it from you. Because it goes back millennia, probably, those rituals.
Yeah, and another thing also was that, of course, I don't know about in Iran and elsewhere in the Spanish countries, but like in Asia, you are supposed to finish everything you have on your plate. If you don't finish it, it's impolite, because that means the food is not good enough. Whereas, of course, in the United States, if you finish the food, then you are glut.
Right. Yeah.
So it's one of those things that it's a little bit different.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there are these little details that you trip over, obviously, as you learn as a child after you're going hungry. And when you're, you know, in the home of an Iranian and you realize that you've seemed terribly greedy because you immediately say yes to everything they offer. So, but I think beyond that, just kind of understanding the goodwill behind people's gestures, you can correct your faux pas.
Right. Well, in the West, in America especially, food has just become a consumption of convenience, whereas other countries and cultures, food is a sustenance of life. So there's a different sense of appreciation for food.
Right. And sharing a meal with someone is really significant.
That's right.
It's not just fuel until the next
yeah.
4 hours.
That's right. What is the motivation behind writing Aliens and Other Stories?
Well, I think sort of connecting what we were saying before, I mean, having these experiences of living in different cultures and feeling that even after I learned the language, that I would sometimes not totally understand the way other people were thinking. When we moved to Washington, D.C., both my husband and I and our children, we tended to make friends with people who were from other countries because we also felt somehow, even though we were American citizens, that we were strangers. And so that sense of not quite fitting in and trying to adjust, we lived so much of the time when we were in Latin America, it was an experience all over again. And so I started thinking a lot about people who come to this country and all of the things that they have left behind, all of the stories, some of them tragic, that they somehow have to incorporate that past with living here, made me want to write stories about people who had done that. I wrote a couple of stories very early on while we were still in South America, kind of, and then I realized that the story continued in this country.
Interesting. So, please give us a synopsis of the book.
Well, it's a collection of short stories, but they're centered around a character named Gabriel Baum, who's a journalist in Argentina, and he disappears during a dictatorship in the late 1970s and early 1980s where 30,000 people were arrested. Many went to clandestine prisons, and some were tortured, some were never seen again. Gabriel is a journalist who is arrested during this dictatorship, as many journalists were. And his wife, after he disappears, comes to Washington with her two young children and makes a life for herself here. And so that's sort of the cornerstone story. And then the other stories are about, one is about a friend of his who was a playwright who did get released from jail. He comes to the United States and he marries an American woman. And there's a story about their marriage. There's a story about their son, Joaquin. There's a story about a neighbor girl who lives down the street who's a high school student who falls in love with the son. There's another story about the woman who originally came to the United States and her children growing up. So it's all kind of how this one person and what happened to him kind of ripple out and affect all these different people. So it's a story that kind of, I would say, goes in a, it's almost like a stone being thrown into a pond and you see all the ripples out, rather than a linear straight line where it starts in one place and ends in another.
Sure. It's a beautifully written book. It's wonderful stories, and it really connects with people from a standpoint, this is real life, real situations. These are the plight, the challenges of people living away from their comfort zone, and how do they get adjusted to the life in the new area. Some of them assimilate well, and some of them don't, and then some of them have cultural baggages that they bring with them. Overall, it's just wonderful because it really pushes our thought process in making us being more mindful in the sense that when we look at our neighbor the next time, what are they truly thinking or what are they going through? Are there challenges and rewards that they perceive as rewards? Are they the same as ours?
Right, right. I think that hopefully it will give people a sense of people that they see as other are, you know, have a whole history that that we might not necessarily see.
Very interesting. How did you come up with the various stories and characters?
Well, one of the earliest stories that I wrote for the book is actually the last story, which is about two couples who live in a building in Argentina. One of the couples are Jewish, and they left Germany and settled in Argentina before the Second World War. And the other couple who live in the building are a former SS officer and his wife. And this story was actually based on two couples who did live in the building where my husband lived in Buenos Aires when I first met him. And he told me the story of these two couples and how they never spoke to each other because they lived on the same corridor, but they would just turn their heads and not speak. And the two men died within a week of each other. And after they had died, the widows became the best of friends, and they were friends for the rest of their lives. They both spoke German as their first language, and they managed to bridge this enormous gap of politics and hatred too. So that is the one, I think, completely true story in the book, although I imagined it from the point of view of one of the women, and the details are my own. So some of the stories were inspired by little things that happened, but many were just kind of snippets of things that I would hear, and then I would also think about, well, so what would it be like to be a neighbor of this person, or what would it be like to be the child of this character? So
wonderful. Were there challenges in putting the book together?
Yes, I think so. They were, at first I wasn't so clear that the stories were connected, but as different characters started reemerging, or a peripheral character in one story would then become the star of the next story, I thought, well, I think these are really connected. So the one thing that I wanted to do, too, was to feel that although I wasn't writing about my own culture, that I do it in a way that didn't make people seem exotic. And so I was always trying to find a voice that seemed accessible to me and use details that I knew were real. The sense of being in the lives of these characters rather than looking at them was what I wanted to do.
Did you do a lot of research for the book?
Well, not much. A lot of the initial research I did actually was when I first went to Argentina to do a guidebook. This was in 1987, and the dictatorship had ended 3 years earlier. Mm-hmm. But it was very much on people's minds. And many people who had been in college in the late 70s and early 80s and had, you know, were arrested for things like protesting the rise of bus fares or having the wrong book in their apartment, things like that. So when I was doing this guidebook and we'd be talking about maps and restaurants and things like that, and people would suddenly just break off and tell me some story about being arrested or a friend of theirs who had disappeared, and I didn't know what to do with this information because I couldn't really put it in the guidebook. So it all kind of stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was actually writing the stories, as I said, my husband is a journalist, and so he was a good source of making sure that I got the right things happening in the right years.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Another person who was really important was a friend of ours named Mario Diament, who after there was a famous newspaper editor named Jacob Timmerman, whose disappearance caused an international outcry. And Mario became the editor of the newspaper La Opinion after Timmerman was arrested. And so because he was a friend, I was able to talk to him a lot about what it was like to work at a newspaper, what things you could write and what you couldn't. And,
right.
And he was a very good source, too.
That's wonderful. What was the toughest thing for you to write in the book?
Well, I think thinking about what it was actually like to be a prisoner, to suddenly have everything taken away, to face the possibility of being disappeared, was a really terrifying thing, and I felt that it maybe was an experience, since I hadn't had it, that I didn't want to write about directly. And
yeah.
So I wrote a lot more about how these disappearances affected the people who are left behind, because it seemed that I didn't really have the right to recreate the experience of,
mm-hmm.
of being a prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
So,
interesting.
I chose not to have an actual prison scenes in the book.
One of the things you talk about in the book as well, and these are things that I have encountered, people that in a situation where the husbands are separated from the wives and the families and so forth, and before you know it, you have two different families in two different countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, right. I mean, people and just the experience of being separated for a long time often does make people very... It changes them, makes them very different. And so going back to the way things are is very difficult. The story about Gabriel, the disappeared journalist, and his wife, Sonia, she continues to talk to her husband. She knows that she's about 99% sure that he's no longer alive. But she talks to him all the time as though they were still married, and she doesn't really think that he's in the room with her, but it somehow comforts her to talk to him and imagine even at one point a soldier or a policeman suggests to her that maybe her husband ran off with her sister, who was a well-known poet who had also disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And Sonia, even the idea that maybe her husband has betrayed her with her sister and they're living in Australia and going to the beach every day, that even that idea, as painful as it is, seems preferable to thinking that he no longer exists. So she does take up with a friend of his who is married to somebody else, I wanted to even make that love affair understandable from her point of view, because she wants so much some connection with this person who's disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose for the book to be a fiction?
Well, I think that there have been a couple of really excellent books about this period of Argentine history, mm-hmm. and I felt that one of them is Taking a Stand by Juan Mendez, who is he was also a political prisoner, and he's now a human rights lawyer and professor in Washington, D.C. But I felt that there were elements of these experiences that lent themselves more to fiction, because they were more about how these experiences affected someone's day-to-day life, or they affected the child of someone who disappeared, who ends up going to public schools in Maryland and is thinking about prom and beer parties and things like that. But in the back of his mind is the knowledge that his father was this sort of martyr. And so I think that is true to life. I mean, the kind of mundane and the dramatic are always mixed together in our lives. But it seems that fiction is really the way to express how we have these kind of both the huge sweep of history and then the dailiness mm-hmm. of life. They're all in one package, really.
Right. How much of you is in the book?
Well, I would say, in some ways, as in a dream. You know, they say in your dreams that every character is actually you. And
yeah.
I would say in that way, that's true of this book. Just insofar as that every character is somehow my imagining what it would be like to be this character, that character. I think since several of the stories have to do with infidelity, my long-suffering husband, I often say, well, you know, these are all just imaginary. So, I think the circumstances people find themselves in, clearly you don't necessarily want to have happily married and their children are doing great, because that doesn't make very good fiction. Although
right.
one thing that when I was in a writing workshop, people pointed out to me that although I do often write about marriage in crisis and people getting divorced and people having affairs, that the couples are always really nice to each other. And so maybe I wasn't able to make that final leap into a horrible marriage. Even though these people are doing things they shouldn't, they have a nice relationship, or they have a nice bond.
Interesting. Very interesting. Who should read this book?
Well, I hope it will appeal not only to people who might have an interest in Latin America, but just people who are curious. I mean, so much of our lives all over the United States now have to do with the confrontation of cultures, and even in places where before there were very few immigrants, now there are many. And so I think being able to imagine the experiences of people who seem very different from you is probably something that's helpful for not only people interested in Latin America, but just kind of being curious about those who are around them.
That's true, very true. Another thing also, I find that you are covering issues that are pretty much worldwide. It's got nothing to do with those specific areas, whether it's in Madrid or in Argentina. We are travelers now. We no longer work in the community that we lived in. So as such, there's a tremendous amount of displacement. And this displacement causes ripple effects. And some of them are huge ripples, and some of them are not so huge. But in the end, the human elements, the story of the human connections, those are real.
Right. And I think, too, that it's by going to the very specific that you you get to the general. The even people who have no experience of this. I mean, you think of all the political upheavals that have occurred since this event in Argentina. All over the world, there have been, unfortunately, you know, terrible dictatorships where people have disappeared, and these things keep happening. So I think focusing on something that happened now many years ago and is particular to one time in one part of the world, it has resonance, and particularly as I was working on these stories, pretty much I started around the time of 9/11 and when we started seeing stories about people taken prisoner, an extraordinary rendition, and was torture ever a good idea, and all of these things that to my mind were settled, and suddenly they're being debated in our country whether it was okay to torture someone, and so I think that the issues that were raised then are still very much present, and I kept seeing, and maybe this is just what happens as you get older too. You do start seeing history repeat itself, and the same kinds of questions reemerging. So you want to say, wait, this has already happened, and it did not turn out well. So stop.
Right. Right. That's true. Well, your book certainly gives us an insight look, a snapshot of how the people that are living away, either by design or certainly most of the time not by their choice, because in the end, coming to full circle, we all have one thing in mind, the pursuit of happiness with ourselves, with our family. And here, through events that we have no control over, displaces us into different areas of the world in this case. Of course, you're focusing on those specific areas that you're familiar with, but I think the ripple effect goes over in today's world from the standpoint of all the refugees from the various parts of the world, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, the Palestinians. These are real, and sometimes we don't hear the actual stories of these people that live in exile. I was at a party over the weekend and happened to talk to someone who has tremendous insights of what's going on in the Middle East, for example. And one of the things he told me was, for example, in Jordan, the third largest city in Jordan now is actually a refugee camp that has been around forever since the Palestinian war. And now you have, of course, the Syrian refugees are coming over. So we can't imagine those kind of things living in the United States and not being able to picture something like that. So that's fascinating to be thinking, and having authors like you to kind of every so often throw something in front of us and just say, hey guys, be a little bit mindful about things like this, because this is about the rest of the story, so to speak.
All of us who live in the United States are in one way or another the children or the descendants of refugees. I mean, not always, you know, as dire as something like Syria, where you're fleeing for your life, but that sense of leaving the place that you're from and going somewhere else and making a new life for yourself. I mean, that's in all of our DNA, and so I think that it's an idea that really resonates with Americans, that it is possible to go someplace else and to start your life over, but it's not risk free, and you do carry your past with you, and the past is that you carry with you, sort of it goes into the soup that makes our country and really does enrich it. As much as people resist it in the moment and say, oh no more, the old people that came, that's fine, but nobody knew.
Right.
so.
Well, the experience enriches everyone, the
mm-hmm.
people that are
mm-hmm.
on the outside, as well as the people that are actually going through the process.
Right, right, right.
What would you like for your readers to gain from reading Aliens and Other Stories?
Well, hopefully they will maybe learn a little bit about this particular time and these people. Hopefully also they will be entertained. I think many of the stories, I mean, we've been talking about very serious subjects, but a lot of the stories actually have a lot of funny elements to them too. And there is hopefully entertainment as well as insight into the way that other people think. I always feel with a book that if it's funny, I will forgive a lot of other flaws, but if it's dead
yeah.
serious, it really has to be perfect. So I guess whatever flaws my book has, I hope the humor the humor is like some kind of frosting that makes up for it.
That's a good way of looking at it. What were the rewards that you receive in writing the book in terms of experience?
Well, I would say one of the most rewarding and surprising things that has happened to me occasionally, especially a lot of these stories were published first in different literary magazines, is that I'd hear from people who would say, you wrote exactly the story of my mother, or this exact same thing happened to me. And it would just be such an amazing thing because these stories are made up, and the characters have come out of my head or out of my dreams or wherever they come from, and so to hear from people that this really did correspond to their reality it never ceased to amaze and gratify me whenever I heard that.
Wonderful. Do you think the book can promote a better understanding about people from different cultures, beliefs, and social standings in some ways?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think probably someone who wasn't interested in understanding people probably wouldn't pick it up in the beginning. So I'm probably already preaching to the converted in that way. But I think generally, when you sit down to read any work of fiction, you're sort of turning yourself over to somebody else and to their sensibility. So I think, you know, even if you're reading a novel that's set in your hometown, which you've never left, you're probably going to encounter a certain alien world and be enriched by it. So I think that readers in general are they have to be very open-minded or they wouldn't keep reading.
That's true. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Oh, okay. Well, this the publisher of my book is Washington Writers Publishing House. It's a small cooperative press in Washington, D.C. that's been around for about 35 years, and they have an annual fiction contest. Since it is a very small press, Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com are two ways that you can get the book. Through IndieBound, if you have a small independent bookstore in your area, you can ask them about acquiring it through IndieBound, and that's another way to support independent bookstores. I have a website, KathleenWheaton.com, which has more information about the book and some of short stories that have appeared in other places. There's also some journalism and interviews that I've done. And I'm doing a reading next Monday in Arlington, Virginia, at a small bookstore called One More Page. And but readings and things like that will all be posted on the website. And I'm also on Twitter. I don't tweet a lot, but I'm trying to do more.
Wonderful. How has writing Aliens and Other Stories impacted you personally?
Yeah, well, I think the writing part of it certainly clarifies a lot of ideas in your mind, and then having the book published makes it possible to share them with even more people. And there is this also, I think, this sense of affirmation that is maybe hard to underestimate about having your book accepted for a publication, because you feel that other people have enjoyed it and mm-hmm. want to share it.
Wonderful. So, what is next for you?
Well, I had thought that probably I should write a novel, and I'm still telling myself that I should write a novel, although I'm working on a collection of short stories. I really do love short stories, I'll have to say. They're something that require a lot of attention, both to read and I think to write, you feel that every word has to count. But I really do love them, so I have a feeling that if I publish another book, it probably will be a short story collection.
Interesting. Well, Kathleen, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since this show is about people, family, and living life, do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Well, I read something. I worked briefly at the New Yorker magazine in the mid-1980s, and there was a writer there named Calvin Trillin who, in one of his essays, quoted his father, whose mantra was, "Why not be a mensch?" And that seemed to just kind of sum up all the great religions and just really, you know, why not do the right thing? Why not treat people kindly? I think 99% of the time, it's the right move, and so you could pretty much make it your universal rule that if you treat people kindly, you're probably doing the right thing.
That's fantastic. Simple, direct, and to the point in terms of being mindful. No question about that. Well, that's wonderful. Kathleen, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be best-selling author Lisa Wingate. Lisa and I will be discussing her latest release, The Prayer Box. It is a book about celebration of the untold stories of hope, wishes, fear, and love. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Kathleen, thank you again. It's been a pleasure. Have a blessed day.
Thank you so much, Johnny. I've really appreciated this. It's been lots of fun. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.